And I hastened to the ring hall and saluted Hrothgar. Once he discovered why I had come, the son of Halfdane sent me immediately to sit with his own sons on the bench. It was a happy gathering. In my whole life I have never seen mead enjoyed more in any hall on earth. Sometimes the queen herself appeared, peace pledge between nations, to hearten the young ones and hand out a talk to a warrior, then take her place. Sometimes Hrothgar's daughter distributed ale to older ranks, in order on the benches. I heard the company call her Freyawaru as she made her rounds, presenting men with the gem-studded bowl. Young bride-to-be to the gracious Ingild, in her gold-trimmed attire. The friend of the Shieldings favors her betrothal. The guardian of the kingdom sees good in it, and hopes this woman will heal old wounds and grievous feuds. But generally the spear is prompt to retaliate when a prince is killed, no matter how admirable the bride may be. Think how the Hathabards will be bound to feel, their lord, Ingeld, and his loyal thanes, when he walks in with that woman to the feast. Danes are at the table being entertained, honored guests in glittering regalia, burnished ring-mail that was their host's birthright, looted when the Hathabards could no longer wield their weapons in the shield clash, when they went down with their beloved comrades and forfeited their lives. Then an old spearman will speak while they are drinking, having glimpsed some heirloom that brings alive memories of the massacre. His mood will darken, and heart-stricken, in the stress of his emotion, he will begin to test a young man's temper and stir up trouble. Starting like this, "Now, my friend, don't you recognize your father's sword, his favorite weapon, the one he wore when he went out in his war mask to face the Danes on that final day?" After Weathergeld died and his men were doomed, the Shieldings quickly claimed the field, and now here's a son of one or other of those same killers coming through our hall, overbearing us, mouthing boasts, and rigged in armor that by right is yours. And so he keeps on, recalling and accusing, working things up with bitter words, until one of the lady's retainers lies spattered in blood, split open on his father's account. The killer knows the lie of the land and escapes with his life. Then on both sides the oath-bound lords will break the peace. A passionate hate will build up in Ingeld, and love for his bride will falter in him as the feud rankles. I therefore suspect the good faith of the Hathabards, the truth of their friendship and the trustworthiness of their alliance with the Danes. But now, my lord, I shall carry on with my account of Grendel, the whole story of everything that happened in the hand-to-hand fight. After Heaven's gem had gone mildly to earth, that maddened spirit, the terror of those twilights, came to attack us where we stood guard, still safe inside the hall. There, deadly violence came down on Hanshiel, and he fell as fate ordained, the first to perish, rigged out for the combat. A comrade from our ranks had come to grief in Grendel's maw. He ate up the entire body. There was blood on his teeth. He was bloated and furious, all roused up, yet still unready to leave the hall empty-handed. Renowned for his might, he matched himself against me, wildly reaching. He had this roomy pouch, a strange accoutrement, intricately strung and hung at the ready, a rare patchwork of devilishly fitted dragon skins. I had done him no wrong, yet the raging demon wanted to cram me and many another into this bag. But it was not to be, once I got to my feet in a blind fury. It would take too long to tell how I repaid the terror of the land for every life he took. And so, one credit for you, my king, and for all your people. And although he got away to enjoy life's sweetness for a while longer, his right hand stayed behind him in Herat, evidence of his miserable overthrow as he dived into murk on the mere bottom. I got lavish rewards from the Lord of the Danes for my part in the battle, beaten gold and much else, Once morning came and we took our places at the banquet table. There were singing and excitement. An old reciter, a carrier of stories, recalled the early days. At times, some hero made the timbered harp tremble with sweetness, or related true and tragic happenings. At times, the king gave the proper turn to some fantastic tale, or a battle-scarred veteran, bowed with age, would begin to remember the martial deeds of his youth and prime, and be overcome as the past welled up in his wintry heart. We were happy there the whole day long, and enjoyed our time until another night descended upon us. Then, suddenly, the vehement mother avenged her son and wreaked destruction. Death had robbed her. Geats had slain Grendel, so his ghastly dam struck back and with bare-faced defiance laid a man low. Thus life departed from the sage Asherah, an elder wise in counsel. But afterwards, on the morning following, the Danes could not burn the dead body nor lay the remains of the man they loved on his funeral pyre. She had fled with the corpse and taken refuge beneath torrents on the mountain. It was a hard blow for Hrothgar to bear, harder than any he had undergone before. And so the heartsore king beseeched me in your royal name to take my chances underwater, to win glory and prove my worth. He promised me rewards. Hence, as is well known, I went to my encounter with the terrormonger at the bottom of the tarn. For a while it was hand to hand between us. Then blood went curling along the currents, and I beheaded Grendel's mother in the hall with a mighty sword. I barely managed to escape with my life. My time had not yet come. But Halfdane's heir, the shelter of those earls, again endowed me with gifts in abundance. Thus the king acted with due custom. I was paid and recompensed completely, given full measure and the freedom to choose from Hrothgar's treasures by Hrothgar himself. These, King Hujalak, I am happy to present to you as gifts. It is still upon your grace that all favor depends. I have few kinsmen who are close, my king, except for your kind self. Then he ordered the boar-framed standard to be brought, the battle-topping helmet, the mail shirt gray as hoar-frost, and the precious war-sword, and proceeded with his speech. When Hrothgar presented this war-gear to me, he instructed me, my lord, to give you some account of why it signifies his special favor. He said it had belonged to his older brother, King Haragar, who had long kept it, but that Haragar had never bequeathed it to his son, Hereward, that worthy scion, loyal as he was. Enjoy it well. I heard four horses were handed over next. Beowulf bestowed four bay steeds to go with the armor, swift gallopers all alike. So ought a kinsman act, instead of plotting and planning in secret to bring people to grief, or conspiring to arrange the death of comrades. The warrior king was uncle to Beowulf, and honored by his nephew. Each was concerned for the other's good. I heard he presented Hugh with a gorget, the priceless torque that the prince's daughter, Wealtheow, had given him, and three horses, supple creatures, brilliantly saddled. The bright necklace would be luminous on Hugh's breast. Thus Beowulf bore himself with valor. He was formidable in battle, yet behaved with honor, and took no advantage, never cut down a comrade who was drunk, kept his temper, and, warrior that he was, watched and controlled his God-sent strength and his outstanding natural powers. He had been poorly regarded for a long time, was taken by the Geats for less than he was worth, and their lord, too, had never much esteemed him in the mead-hall. They firmly believed that he lacked force, that the prince was a weakling. But presently, every affront to his deserving was reversed. The battle-famed king, bulwark of his earls, ordered a gold-chased heirloom of Hrethel's to be brought in. It was the best example of a gem-studded sword in the Geat treasury. This he laid on Beowulf's lap, and then rewarded him with land as well, 7,000 hides, and a hall and a throne. Both owned land by birth in that country, ancestral grounds. But the greater right and sway were inherited by the higher born. A lot was to happen in later days in the fury of battle. Hugulak fell, and the shelter of Heardred's shield proved useless against the fierce aggression of the Silfings. Ruthless swordsmen, seasoned campaigners, they came against him and his conquering nation, and with cruel force cut him down, so that afterwards the wide kingdom reverted to Beowulf. He ruled it well for 50 winters, grew old and wise as warden of the land, until one began to dominate the dark, a dragon on the prowl from the steep vaults of a stone-roofed barrow where he guarded a hoard. There was a hidden passage unknown to men, but someone managed to enter by it and interfere with the heathen trove. He had handled and removed a gem-studded goblet. It gained him nothing, though with the thief's wiles he had outwitted the sleeping dragon. That drove him into rage, as the people of that country would soon discover. The intruder who broached the dragon's treasure and moved him to wrath had never meant to. It was desperation on the part of a slave, fleeing the heavy hand of some master, guilt-ridden and on the run, going to ground. But he soon began to shake with terror. In shock, the wretch panicked and ran away with the precious metalwork. There were many other heirlooms heaped inside the earth house, because long ago, with deliberate care, somebody now forgotten had buried the riches of a high-born race in this ancient cache. Death had come and taken them all in times gone by, and the only one left to tell their tale, the last of their line, could look forward to nothing but the same fate for himself. He foresaw that his joy in the treasure would be brief. A newly constructed barrow stood waiting, on a wide headland close to the waves, its entryway secured. Into it the keeper of the hoard had carried all the goods and golden ware worth preserving. His words were few. "Now, earth, hold what earls once held and heroes can no more. It was mined from you first by honorable men. My own people have been ruined in war. One by one they went down to death, looked their last on sweet life in the hall. I am left with nobody to bear a sword or burnish plated goblets, put a sheen on the cup. The companies have departed. The hard helmet, hasped with gold, will be stripped of its hoops, and the helmet shiner who should polish the metal of the war mask sleeps. The coat of mail that came through all fights, through shield collapse and cut of sword, decays with the warrior. Nor may webbed mail range far and wide on the warlord's back, beside his mustered troops. No trembling harp, no tuned timber, no tumbling hawk swerving through the hall, no swift horse pawing the courtyard. Pillage and slaughter have emptied the earth of entire peoples." And so he mourned, as he moved about the world, deserted and alone, lamenting his unhappiness day and night, until death's flood brimmed up in his heart. Then, an old harrower of the dark happened to find the hoard open. The burning one who hunts out barrows, the slick-skinned dragon threatening the night sky with streamers of fire. People on the farms are in dread of him. He is driven to hunt out hordes underground, to guard heathen gold through age-long vigils, though to little avail. For 3 centuries, this scourge of the people had stood guard on that stoutly protected underground treasury, until the intruder unleashed its fury. He hurried to his lord with the gold-plated cup, and made his plea to be reinstated. Then the vault was rifled, the ring hoard robbed, and the wretched man had his request granted. His master gazed on that find from the past for the first time. When the dragon awoke, trouble flared again. He rippled down the rock, writhing with anger when he saw the footprints of the prowler who had stolen too close to his dreaming head. So may a man not marked by fate easily escape exile and woe by the grace of God. The horde guardian scorched the ground as he scoured and hunted for the trespasser who had troubled his sleep. Hot and savage, he kept circling and circling the outside of the mound. No man appeared in that desert waste, but he worked himself up by imagining battle. Then back in he'd go in search of the cup, only to discover signs that someone had stumbled upon the golden treasures. So the guardian of the mound, the horde watcher, waited for the gloaming with fierce impatience. His pent-up fury at the loss of the vessel made him long to hit back and lash out in flames. Then, to his delight, the day waned, and he could wait no longer behind the wall, but hurtled forth in a fiery blaze. The first to suffer were the people and the land, but before long it was their treasure-giver who would come to grief. The dragon began to belch out flames and burn bright homesteads. There was a hot glow that scared everyone, for the vile sky-winger would leave nothing alive in his wake. Everywhere the havoc he wrought was in evidence. Far and near, the Gaeth nation bore the brunt of his brutal assaults and virulent hate. Then back to the horde he would dart before daybreak to hide in his den. He had swinged the land, swathed it in flame, in fire and burning, and now he felt secure in the vaults of his barrow. But his trust was unavailing. Then Beowulf was given bad news, a hard truth. His own home, the best of buildings, had been burnt to a cinder, the throne room of the Geats. It threw the hero into deep anguish and darkened his mood. The wise man thought he must have thwarted ancient ordinance of the Eternal Lord, broken his commandment. His mind was in turmoil. Unaccustomed anxiety and gloom confused his brain. The fire dragon had razed the coastal region and reduced forts and earthworks to dust and ashes. So the war king planned and plotted his revenge. The warrior's protector, prince of the hall troop, ordered a marvelous all-iron shield from his smithy works. He well knew that linden boards would let him down and timber burn. After many trials, he was destined to face the end of his days in this mortal world, as was the dragon, for all his long leasehold on the treasure. Yet the Prince of the Rings was too proud to line up with a large army against the Sky Plague. He had scant regard for the dragon as a threat, no dread at all of its courage or strength, for he had kept going often in the past, through perils and ordeals of every sort, after he had purged Hrothgar's hall, triumphed in Heorot, and beaten Grendel. He outgrappled the monster and his evil kin. One of his cruelest hand-to-hand encounters had happened when Hugolak, king of the Geats, was killed in Friesland. The people's friend and lord, Hrethel's son, slaked a sword-blade's thirst for blood. but Beowulf's prodigious gifts as a swimmer guaranteed his safety. He arrived at the shore,